It's 9:06. Good morning. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. According to news reports from Zimbabwe this morning, the ruling party of President Robert Mugabe has privately conceded a loss in the first round of presidential balloting to opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai. Official election results still haven't been released 4 days after Saturday's election. This morning's news report suggests that no candidate achieved a plurality of the vote, meaning that there will be a runoff election in about 3 weeks. Amid charges of vote rigging and threats from the military not to recognize anyone but Mugabe as president, the plight of the average Zimbabwean is somehow diminished. This once prosperous African country has seen its economy collapse, its agricultural system fail, and the life expectancy of its people drop from 60-plus to just 37 for males and 34 years of age for females. So what has gone wrong in Zimbabwe? What does the future hold for this former British colony? If you would like to join the discussion, here are the phone numbers, 800-486-8655. That's a toll-free number, 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, please use our local number, 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. My guest this hour is Edmund J. Keller, Professor of Political Science and Director of the UCLA Globalization Research Center, Africa. He joins us by telephone. Good morning, Professor Keller, and welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Well, help us see what the situation is in Zimbabwe politically. Who are the key players, and what do they propose to do for the country?
Well, of course, key player, the number one key player is President Robert Mugabe, who's been in power for about 28 years, or I should say, 28 years. His main opposition is a businessman by the name of Morgan Tsvangirai. There was a third opposition candidate whose name is Simba Mokone, and Simba Mokone is a former minister of finance, PhD in biochemistry, very impressive man in his early 50s, but he never completely broke away from ZANU-PF. He remained, he continued to carry the label of ZANU-PF, which essentially meant that there was a faction of ZANU-PF running against Mugabe. And the MDC, Movement for Democratic Change, is headed up by Morgan Tsvangirai. There was another candidate, minority candidate, but he was not a serious challenger. He was a breakaway. He led a breakaway faction from the Movement for Democratic Change.
So ZANU-PF is the political party of which President Mugabe is a member then?
Yes. Zambia African National Congress, the Patriotic Front wing, waged a guerrilla warfare against the white minority regime from 1965 all the way up until 1980, when white minority rule was ended, and there was for about a 10-year period power-sharing government, which included whites as well as ZANU-PF. But since 1990, ZANU-PF has had the field more or less to itself. There have been opposition parties now and then, but none have been able to challenge. Mugabe comes from the Shona ethnic group, and they comprise about 75% of the total population. So he's been able to rely upon his kin, his relations in that ethnic group to maintain himself in power.
When Robert Mugabe took power in Zimbabwe, things were going fairly well for the country, at least according to what I've read. The economy seemed to be in pretty good shape. There was a decent education system. Health care was available. Certainly the life expectancy of the average Zimbabwean was much longer than it is today. But somewhere along the line, the train kind of went off the tracks. What happened?
Well, you know, what you say is relatively true, but we have to put that into perspective. actually was a white settler colony up until, well, it was called Southern Rhodesia at the time. As a consequence, you had white farmers and business people who were the backbone of the economy, and they owned these large farms on which black labor worked, they built a very successful economy growing cotton and tobacco and other kinds of agricultural commodities. Once independence came, there was a clamor among the black population for a redistribution of wealth, for a redistribution of land, and so forth and so on. And Mugabe has always had that pressure, you know, to do something to alleviate the poverty, underdevelopment, unemployment among the black population. And in his efforts to satisfy that demand, he went after the white farmers. It took him 20 years before he really went after them, but in 2000, he decided that he was going to confiscate white farms and to parcel them out among black farmers, and that's when the economy started to go south, so to speak.
I understand that there have been problems with delivering electricity due to some unpaid electric bills. Zimbabwe gets its most of its electricity from nearby Mozambique, I believe it is, and
yes.
they haven't been able to pay their bills, and so the power hasn't been reliable of late.
Yeah, because, you know, right now, the Zimbabwe dollar it takes about 25,000 Zimbabwe, 25 million, I'm sorry, Zimbabwe dollars to equate to one U.S. dollar right now. The inflation rate is running about 150,000% in Zimbabwe. So there's a premium on hard currency, foreign currency. The government continues to print money, its own local currency, and therefore when it does that, the currency becomes less and less worth anything. So it does not have a lot of hard currency in its coffers, and therefore it's been unable to pay its bills. It claims that its troubles can be linked to sanctions against the government levied by Western countries like the United States and the European Union. But there are no such sanctions. There are sanctions against individuals close to the government, there are no sanctions against the country per se.
The head of the armed forces has referred to opposition presidential candidates as sellouts. What does he mean by that?
Well, you know... Mugabe has always wanted to create a party, ZANU-PF, which was more or less like a vanguard communist party, okay? And that would have relied heavily upon absolute loyalty on the part of everybody in the country, and he's not been able to get that. More than that, when he says that the opposition are sellouts, he's mainly talking about Simba Mokone, who had been one of his most trusted lieutenants within ZANU-PF until about 5 months ago when he broke away and decided he was going to run against Mugabe. So that's basically what they're talking about.
More ominously, the head of the armed forces has said he will refuse to acknowledge anyone but Mugabe as president Is that some sort of a threat of a military coup if Mugabe doesn't retain power?
Yeah, it's always that's always the kind of a threat that's launched by supporters of Mugabe. Not only the head of the armed forces, but also the head of the prisons in the country, as well as the head of the police force in the country. They've all said things like that, basically to try and intimidate the opposition. But it seems that right now the opposition will not be intimidated. They seem to be laying back. They hope that, in fact, when the verdict is really in, Morgan Tsvangirai will be the outright winner. But if he's not the outright winner, the word is that there will be violence, and it will be violence emanating from the opposition supporters against the ruling party and whoever else supports it. So Zimbabwe, you know, since 1980, every election has been characterized by pre-election violence as well as post-election violence. Up until now, in this election, we've seen pre-election violence, but no serious violence in the aftermath, but that's not to say it won't come. You will recall in Ethiopia back in 2005, there was a peaceful run-up to those elections, but when the results were reported, there was rioting in the streets, and it continued for a good period of time. And that's pretty typical. In Kenya, you saw the same thing just recently in December, where over 1,000 people lost their lives in post-election ethnic violence. So I'm hopeful that there won't be this violence. I'm hopeful that the result will be one that the majority of the population can accept and they can peacefully move on. At least on his part, Morgan Tsvangirai has been speaking in very conciliatory language, calling for calm and really encouraging the people to be patient, saying that they've waited long enough to get to this point, and what they need now is for the whole process to play out and do this in a peaceful manner.
You mentioned sanctions by the European Union and other Western governments against individuals in Zimbabwe. Who are these people, and what? Why are there sanctions against them?
Well, you know, this is a typical method used by governments against individuals who are accused of committing crimes against humanity. There are restrictions placed upon their travel, restrictions on their bank accounts, foreign bank accounts, and so forth and so on. As far as individuals are concerned, I'm afraid I can't tell you exactly who they are, but people that are close to Mugabe, and in fact, some individuals may be on one country's list and not on another's, but I can't tell you exactly who they are.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, maybe some people would like to join us by phone. If you have a question about Zimbabwe and the situation there, African politics in that particular country, what's going on with them and with the people of Zimbabwe, you can give us a call at 800-486-8655. That's a toll-free number, 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, use our local number, 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn this morning. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 21 minutes after 9 o'clock, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's what's coming up a little bit later on today. What triggered the protests in Tibet? Does China's reaction have anything to do with recent independence in Kosovo and Taiwan's presidential election? What is U.S. policy toward Tibet? After 3 on Here on Earth, Jean Faraca and her guests have an in-depth discussion about the situation in Tibet. That's after 3 o'clock this afternoon. This hour, it's the situation in Zimbabwe that is on our minds, and my guest by phone is Edmund J. Keller, professor of political science and director of the UCLA Globalization Research Center Africa. As I said, he joins us by telephone, and you can too. Here are the numbers. We do have lines available for you. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, 227-2050, 227-2050. Well, Professor, in the time before, leading up to the mid-1980s, most of the second half century of the 20th century, the United States was engaged in the Cold War with the Soviet Union, and Africa was one of the areas where this played out with the conflict via surrogates between the United States and the Soviet Union. How, if at all, was what is now known as Zimbabwe involved in that particular conflict?
Well, you have to understand that Britain had two settler colonies during the colonial era. One was Kenya, the other was Zimbabwe, or which was southern Rhodesia at the time. In Kenya, in the early 60s, late 50s, early 60s, there was a guerrilla movement, independence movement, which caused the colonialists quite a bit of difficulty, but they came to an agreement and a peaceful settlement and a surrender of the reins of power to a black-led government. But in Zimbabwe, what happened was the British wanted to do the same in southern Rhodesia, but the white settlers there were organized, and in 1965 they declared their independence, which was called the UDI, Unilateral Declaration of Independence. And at the same time, African opposition forces, nationalists, stepped up their own campaign. And for about 15 years, there was a bloody a war between African opposition and the white settlers. Now, that particular situation was characterized by sanctions. The British did not want the white settlers to declare independence, and they imposed sanctions. But those sanctions were broken by South Africa, which became very close to southern Rhodesia and became a major trading partner, a provider of arms and so forth and so on. And right next to South Africa and right near southern Rhodesia, the Portuguese had the colony of Mozambique, and the South Africans fought in Mozambique. The South Africans wanted to project the image of being a bulwark against communism in southern Africa, and it served as proxies for the U.S. and the West in Cold War battles against China as well as the Soviets. So that's basically how Zimbabwe or Rhodesia was somehow involved, but it wasn't directly involved.
We have a caller who wants to join us, and let's go and take a call from Bill in New Glarus. Bill, good morning. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. Great show. I just have a question. Why do I primarily have to rely on looking at the Globe and Mail out of Canada and the Times of London and other mostly British Commonwealth newspapers to find out what's going on in Zimbabwe? I don't see much coverage in the United States media, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Bill. Professor?
Yeah, well, you've hit on a really big problem for people like yourself and myself. You know, I, too, rely upon those sources that you talked about, particularly because the U.S. media, particularly the local media, do not have adequate international coverage. The New York Times today had a very extensive article, which is a very good article. I would recommend that you look at it. Periodically, newspapers like the Dallas Morning News or the San Francisco Chronicle and the L.A. Times, they also have coverage, but it's sporadic. You know, I find that the Internet is my best friend when it comes to trying to keep up and to get some sort of reliable information as to what's going on, not only in Zimbabwe, but elsewhere in the world as well.
There are some really good African-based newspapers online. I don't remember the names of them, but when I was researching this, I found a whole bunch of different sites where you could go and get information about that part of the world, and it was a real revelation. As you say, there isn't that much news coverage, although I will say I'll blow NPR's horn, both Morning Edition and in the NPR newscasts, have had coverage of the recent elections in Zimbabwe, but most of us, I don't think, know very much about this country at all. Maybe one of the things we ought to do is try and describe what the country of Zimbabwe is like Physically, I mean, where we have a rough idea, I think, of where it's located on the map of Africa, but what kind of country is this? What are its natural resources? What are the things that could be used by its people to bring the economy back and kind of restore things there? What sort of country is Zimbabwe?
Well, it's a magnificent country, very diverse ecologically. It's in some parts there are some very impressive game reserves, picturesque waterfowls. It's a real tourist haven, if you will. Cities, it's not very urbanized. There are a couple of good-sized cities, including Harare, which is the capital city. But what you're struck by is the abject poverty of the majority of the population. You're also struck by the fact that you still have a large white population, some of whom still own quite a bit of property, which may not necessarily be agricultural property, but they have a presence there, and they have also an attitude, which is more or less looked upon the African population with condescension. They never really blend it in, whereas in South Africa, right across the border, there was really kind of an epiphany that took place in the early 1990s, and there's been much more racial peace than there has been in Zimbabwe, so to speak. But of course, in Zimbabwe, with the political situation being what it is, the leadership, the black leadership, has been very strident in its dealings with whites. And very recently, what the government did was to pass a law saying that any foreign company that wants to do business in Zimbabwe has to have 51% of its assets controlled by an indigenous partner. So you can see that whites and foreigners are under constant pressure. But the country itself is physically very well endowed, particularly for agriculture and also for mining. However, it's landlocked. It relies upon getting its products to sea on South Africa, Mozambique, and places like that, and even Tanzania.
You referred to the hyperinflation rate, 150,000%. That's a number that most of us probably can't fathom. I mean, the Federal Reserve seems to panic if the inflation rate in this country hits 2 or 3%, let alone 150,000%. That's just an incredible number. How did they get to this point economically?
Well, it's just economic mismanagement. As I said, the government has been in denial. It's created policies which overvalued its currency. It has refused to devalue the currency, although that would help quite a bit in the if you have dollars in Zimbabwe. The dollars go a pretty long ways. As I say, you know, it takes 25 million Zim dollars to equal $1. But if you have dollars and you go into a restaurant or into a shop that has anything that you might want to buy, you can purchase that at a fairly reasonable price, you know. But the fact is that most of the population has only these Zim dollars, which are just basically worthless. So the government, Mugabe in particular, has refused to devalue the currency, refused to reach out to foreign donors and others who might help it get out of its situation. So that's essentially how it got to be the way it is. And then, of course, the instability in the market, in the economy, caused by the nationalization of these white farms and other similar policies.
And that's led to some food shortages, I understand, that bakeries don't have flour to bake bread, and there have been some food shortages that have been blamed on the confiscation of the white farms and the dividing up of the land, that's disrupted the agricultural system in Zimbabwe, I understand.
Yes, that's true. But that's a characteristic of a lot of places in Africa today. Even here, you know, food costs a heck of a lot for us today. And we're a lot better off in terms of being able to afford these price hikes. But when you're eking out an existence where your income, if you're lucky, is in the neighborhood of $100 a year, you don't have much slack in your budget. So I think right now in different places in Africa, you will see these kinds of shortages, which will lead to commodity riots, and Zimbabwe is no different. But at the same time, when you combine that with all of the other problems associated with what's going on there, it really is a horrendous situation. You mentioned about how the life expectancy has gone from over 60 years down to just over 37 years. Well, you know, that's a heck of a statement to make and to be an expression of reality. It's just too bad.
Well, those numbers were in the literature that I read, the articles that I read when I was preparing for the program, were linked to the AIDS epidemic, which, of course, is not unique to Zimbabwe. Most of the continent is suffering from this. But is there anything in Zimbabwe that's unique in terms of how AIDS has affected that country?
Not really. If you think about how the AIDS epidemic has progressed over time, it has traveled throughout Africa through individuals like truck drivers who go from one place to the other, or soldiers, and as a consequence, it's become a national security threat for all of these countries in the region. And Zimbabwe has been involved in conflicts in the northeastern part of the Congo recently. Some of their soldiers have been infected from that. And then, of course, as I say, long-distance trade, prostitution, so forth and so on. And that creeps into the general population because, you know, if soldiers are infected or if prostitutes are infected, individuals, you know, those expected to provide leadership in any society, let's say teachers and other professional people, they may become infected. And, of course, they have contact with young people, students. Sometimes they take advantage of them. Then the students become infected. Husbands who are engaged in unsafe sexual practices bring this epidemic home, too. Zimbabwe, though, is not the worst country in the region. The worst countries in the region infected with HIV/AIDS are Malawi and Botswana. But Southern Africa in general is heavily affected.
We have a call next from Daniel in Rice Lake. Daniel, good morning. Thanks for calling.
Hello. On the BBC's coverage, they mentioned the BBC was expelled from Zimbabwe, so they couldn't say where the reporter was located. Why was the BBC expelled by Mugabe from Zimbabwe?
Well, it's the Western press in general that has been prohibited from covering the news in Zimbabwe, and partly it's because Mugabe feels that they won't treat his regime fairly. And this has been for a long period of time. You haven't had Western journalists, and those that have gotten in have gone in surreptitiously. And so what happens is that the news for Zimbabwe is reported through Johannesburg, South Africa. And occasionally there will be Western journalists who get into the country, but they'll get in as tourists. But then they practice their trade and then get the news out that way. Tourists come in with cameras all the time, They go on safaris. And, of course, you know, they're not watched 100% of the time, but that's the way they sneak in and get the news and then get out.
Daniel, thanks for that call. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655 is the number to call. And we have a line or two available for you right now if you'd like to get in on this program. In Milwaukee, please use our local number, 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. You mentioned President Mugabe of Zimbabwe not liking the Western press, feeling that he doesn't get a fair hearing. Does he have reason to fear the Western press? Do you think he has gotten a fair coverage, or has there been a bias against him?
Well, you know, this whole confiscation of white land was a violent process. You'd have people who claim to be former freedom fighters who would camp out on white farms. At some point, they'd take some desperate measures to evict the white farmers. They'd burn out the houses of the black workers on these white farms and kill people. And all of that initially was being reported in the Western press. And that, of course, you know, created a negative image of what was going on. There was no sympathy in the Western press for, one, the confiscation of these white lands, and two, for the level of violence that was taking place. And, of course, as I said, Mugabe sometimes even exacted these violent measures against people that were thought to be his supporters when he figured that they had betrayed him or betrayed his objectives. So, yeah, I mean, if you get in and you report the real truth of what's going on, in some of these countries, there's not this tolerance of this open and free press. I can recall once I was speaking to a Kenyan person about an incident that had taken place in Kenya where some security folks had beaten up a bunch of students, and she was so embarrassed that this was covered by CNN, you know, and I said, well, look, if CNN had not been there, who would tell your story? I mean, what? You know, are you just going to simply continue to tolerate this kind of thing, or do you want to try to instigate some change? Well, you know, some people feel very embarrassed by these kind of portrayals, not the least of whom are people like Robert Mugabe.
Well, we have some more people who want to join us by phone, so let's take a few calls here. Ellen in Middleton, you're next. Ellen, good morning.
Good morning. As I've been listening, I heard the previous caller's discussion about AIDS in Africa and wanted to say that Madison is going to be highlighting the plight of AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa and its threat to the continent, as well as to the pandemic itself spreading into other parts of the world with a thing called Step into Africa. It's a national tour coming to some 70 cities across the U.S. Madison happens to be one of them. It'll be April 11th through the 14th at Black Hawk Church. It's free to the public, and it's like a virtual tour of an African village featuring the lives of four actual children living in sub-Saharan Africa who've been AIDS affected. And if folks are really wanting to get a deeper understanding through a virtual experience of how that pandemic is affecting and devastating Africa, that'd be a great opportunity. It's free.
Ellen, thanks for sharing that information with us. Appreciate it. 800-486-8655 and 227-2050 are our phone numbers. We do have a line available for you if you call right now. We're talking about the situation in Zimbabwe, and of course, the genesis of the program is the fact that they held an election on Saturday. We're still awaiting the final publication of the election results. It appears that President Robert Mugabe lost, but so far it doesn't look like he lost by enough so that there will be a runoff election in about 3 weeks' time. And we're talking about Zimbabwe today, and you can ask a question of our guest or join in the discussion with your opinion and viewpoint by calling us at 800-486-8655 or 227-2050. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll take some more phone calls. I'm John Munson, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 17 minutes before 10 o'clock, coming up next hour, Mark Vonnegut, son of author Kurt Vonnegut, will join me to discuss Armageddon in Retrospect, a collection of unpublished work by his father, the first since his death a year ago. That's coming up next hour here on the Ideas Network. This hour, Zimbabwe is on our minds, and we have a guest with us to help us sort through recent political events there. Joining me by phone is Edmund J. Keller, Professor of Political Science and Director of the UCLA Globalization Research Center, Africa. We have some callers who want to join us. Let's go back to the phones and take a call from Orville in Madison. Orville, good morning. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Jen. Morning to you and to your guests. This is a very important program, and I want to make a few statements. One is that we have to remember that the land in Zimbabwe or Rhodesia belonged to black people before white people got there. And I've heard black men said that they own tribal lands, and the Ian Smith government came and told them to go away and go someplace else to live and take over their lands and converted them into farms. And that's why they support Mugabe so much, because he's trying to get back the land that had belonged to their families and their tribes for generations. That's one point. The second point is that the Southern Rhodesian farmers, white people, have been so intransigent that they will not make peace with the black people. They hold them apart, and they will not educate or train them to do commercial agriculture. And I had an experience. I was in the Department of Food Science getting a degree many years ago, and there was a white South African girl there. And the moment her father came in and saw that I was in the department, he took her out. He went to the professor and told him to take her out and put her someplace else. That they don't want anything to do with black people. The other thing is that the BBC has had a drumbeat of criticism against Southern Rhodesia, Zambia, day after day, night after night, because they're supporting the white farmers who are not Dutch, as in South Africa. That's why you had the peace in South Africa, because most of the people are Dutch. These are white English people, and the BBC has a drumbeat of criticism against Mugabe and Zambia for months and months and months. And the last thing is, you cannot cure that AIDS epidemic unless there's universal education for all the people in the state. That's the only way to get to the root of that problem. And I thank you for listening to me.
Thanks for the call, Orville. Professor, you care to respond?
Well, several of the points that he makes are very well taken. Zimbabwe, when it was Southern Rhodesia, was a settler colony. At least after World War I, former British soldiers were invited to go to these settler colonies like Kenya, which was called White Man's Country at the time, and they were given land blacks had lived on. But they had an attitude that blacks didn't know anything about work. They didn't know anything about how to be industrious and so forth. And they felt that they had the responsibility of taking this land and to develop it and then to make whatever was produced on that land available to the rest of the world. They didn't really pay much attention to the needs of blacks, except for some missionaries worked to educate blacks so that they eventually came to have a sense that they could control their own destiny. And even Robert Mugabe is a product of that mission education. And the few black intellectuals that did develop during the colonial period in these settler colonies came through that same kind of route. So it was difficult for blacks during the to get adequate education and to participate in politics and so forth and so on. And it was particularly difficult in these settler colonies. In all of Africa, they were only a handful of settler colonies. The Portuguese had Mozambique and Angola. The French had Algeria. The British had Kenya and southern Rhodesia. And, of course, South Africa, people would normally consider that to be a settler colony, but the whites who first came to South Africa came at the same time that the Pilgrims were landing at Plymouth Rock. There was an internal war in South Africa between the British colonialists and the white settlers, who were the descendants of Dutch Calvinists and French Huguenots. They solidified themselves into a new race, the Africana race, and they had this war called the Boer War, which lasted from 1899 up until the turn of the 20th century. And at the end, they reached a settlement, and the Union of South Africa, the independent state of South Africa, was created in 1910. So whites in South Africa don't now see themselves as settlers. They see themselves as Africans, you know, which makes it different from Zimbabwe and other countries like that.
I wanted to talk a little bit about Robert Mugabe's early life and his development and how he came to be in politics in the first place. You mentioned he'd had a missionary education. He eventually, as a politician, was jailed for a fairly extensive period by the Rhodesian government. Talk a little bit about his development and how he got to be, how he came to be the president of Zimbabwe in the first place.
Well, he was a teacher. He was educated as a teacher. He was steeped in the British tradition. If you ever listen to him speak, he is very articulate, sounds as British as anybody can be, and has some of the same values that you would find in aristocrats in Britain. But at the same time, it's sort of like what the previous caller said, that when these settlers took over, and, you know, some of you may remember this, because at the time we were getting programs from Southern Rhodesia, from NBC and other American networks, which was showing how the white settlers were dealing with the black opposition. White settlers walking around with weapons, either handguns or with automatic weapons and whatnot. They were in mortal combat with people like Mugabe. Mugabe was jailed simply because he was trying to initiate an independence movement, an African nationalist movement, and the settlers, the white settlers, would not have it. Ian Smith, who was the leader of the white settlers, could not envision that blacks could ever come to control that country, and therefore he got a lot of white support. But the British really, clumsily as they did maintain pressure, and then they, at an appropriate moment, began to push for negotiations, which Mugabe was involved in, which led to an agreement at Lancaster House in London in 1980, which got us to a point of independence in 80 with this power-sharing arrangement. And then, of course, the transition in 1990. Mugabe was very much of a statesman early on in his career. But as time went by, and as these pressures emanated from the poorest of the poor in Zimbabwe, for him to do something about alleviating their condition, he became much more autocratic. He was never able to create the one-party state that he wanted to. Consequently, he was very tough on opposition and cracked down on them on a number of occasions. But the thing about Mugabe, he has a if you look at his record, he had made tremendous strides in the area of health care for the Zimbabweans, as well as education for the Zimbabweans. But he just could not deal with the economic difficulties that he confronted. And many of these difficulties were of his own making, I must admit. But that's been the Achilles heel for him.
Let's go back to the phones and take a call from Baptist in Green Bay. Good morning.
Hi,
you're on the air.
Good morning, gentlemen. I have a few questions. I was just wondering, why would the world sit and actually let the inflation in Zimbabwe to get to such a standard that people are actually walking around with suitcases of money and they can't even afford to survive? That's just one of my questions, and you gentlemen can comment on it, and then I'll ask the rest.
Well, you know, there's no rational explanation for this. This is terrible. You know, not only what you said is correct, what is worse is that this sort of economic situation has led to an exacerbation of the brain drain. It's estimated that a quarter of the population of Zimbabwe has recently left the country. Some going to South Africa, you know, those with less skills and taking up jobs in South Africa. Those who are professionals will, you know, they may end up being your next-door neighbor because they have something to offer and they cannot achieve their objectives in their own country. But there's no rational explanation for why we got to where we are. It's just that it seems to me just this wanting to hold on to power, wanting to be absolute. So many leaders, what they do in Africa is figure that they're the only ones that really can deliver their people from whatever difficulties they have. And so they end up staying too long, you know, and Mugabe's no different.
All right.
And you had
a couple more. Given what it is, the situation, what it is right now, it is what it is. But the solution of how, ways of moving forward, how do we move forward? How do we help Zimbabwe? There's one question I usually ask, you know, because I run a fair trade store in Green Bay, Wisconsin, and we work with someone who goes directly to Zimbabwe to work with with carvers, stone carvers. And basically, by us helping them out, that's the way they actually can survive and maintain their families. So one question I usually ask for what the whole American audience is, what have we done for the developing world lately? Because if we support fair trade and other ways like this, we are actually helping the economy of Zimbabwe. You gentlemen can comment now.
Okay, thank you. So what can we do?
Well, I tell you what, in order for anybody to do anything, it has to be a two-way street. If Mugabe's in power, he has to somehow loosen up, somehow welcome whatever support might come from outside. And if he's not in power, I would almost venture to guess that whoever is in power will see the wisdom in opening up the system and inviting in whatever assistance can be provided. But there has to be at least willingness on the part of the Zimbabwe leadership to accept this.
Let's try and sneak in one more call. And Sue and Ashland will take your call next. And please be brief. We've only got about a minute left.
Oh, hi. I'll make it quick. This is in response to the gentleman who called who said that HIV can be solved with education. I was the director of an HIV program in the 80s and 90s, and Robert Mugabe has never accepted that HIV is caused by a virus. He's always believed that it's a white man's conspiracy. And that puts him in the same camp with Ahmad Ahmadinejad, someone who doesn't believe the Holocaust exists. He's outside of the pale, and he can't be brought into a logical conversation. And you know, how do we deal with someone like that? He wasn't dealt with in the beginning, and I think that was our mistake.
Thanks for the call, Sue. We've got about 30 seconds here, Professor, to wrap things up.
Well, it's been a very a good conversation. I'm glad that people had such good interventions, and let's all keep our eyes on what's going on in Zimbabwe. Hopefully there will be a good outcome by the weekend.
Thank you so much for spending this hour with us. It was very informative.
Thank you.
Edmund J. Keller is professor of political science and director of the UCLA Globalization Research Center Africa, and he joined us by phone this morning. Thank you to Rhonda Fanning, who produced this program. John Treader handled on-air production. And if you'd like a copy of it, you can call the radio store at 800-747-7444 and ask for program 42D, 42D as in dog. Or you can go to the WPR website and listen to it all over again. It's your choice. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn today. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.